Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this Friday, the 24th of April, 2009, or if you're on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone, it's now Saturday, the 25th of April, 2009. And we've got a great show for you tonight. We're going to talk about some really off-the-shelf stuff. If you tuned in last night, we talked with Ken Adachi, my guest, for about 2 hours, if we could have kept going. And we talked about reptilians. We talked about some famous reptilians in political offices. And I have been working feverishly all day posting the long-awaited article, The Three Stooges Go to Washington, Part 6. And that is just about complete. It's very memory-intensive. There's a lot of sizing and lining up and coding to do, but it's working out admirably, and I'm going to be very pleased with it, and I hope you are when it's done. Be patient. We are anticipating, if it doesn't get up by the early morning hour tonight or this morning, because it is morning already in some places, then it will definitely be up tomorrow. I'm also including with it an independent analysis from a photographic expert, and I'll hold that individual's assessment of my research and the photographs themselves, and we'll see what this person has to say. So, with that, I think we can jump right into the reason why we're all here, and that's because on Friday nights, my good friend, who is also scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Mr. Jim Murray, joins me and as my co-host and my guest. He's wearing two hats tonight and every Friday night. And we welcome him back to Evident Footprints again. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. That's always good to be here.
Well, if you've been anywhere near as busy as me, then you have a busy day as well. And I trust that you're doing well. In case you haven't heard, our regular engineer and board op, Seth Hendrick, lost his father a couple of nights ago. And so we want to extend our condolences out to him. And Don Newsom's going to be doing the sound for us as his replacement. So hopefully we can breeze through the show and not have any problems. I'm not saying Don's going to give us any problems. It's been a crazy past couple of nights. Two nights ago, we had trouble getting our guest on board, and I think we were attacked somewhat. We really had some problems with the servers and our voice over internet protocol, the whole nine yards. So we did an abbreviated show that night, but we're going to make up for it tonight with some hard-hitting facts. I know on the basis of what you and I have talked about over the past couple of months that you had a few things that you wanted to add to our conversation, and we haven't really planned anything other than to try to complete what we've started, and we've been all over the board. I turn the mic over to you, Jim.
Well, thank you, Don. I don't think this will take very long, considering we've labored on this issue of consciousness and human evolution, human spiritual evolution, that is, for, oh, I guess 2 months anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me that there was one other aspect that might be worth discussing, and it's an area that has always been very fascinating for me, and yet it seems to tie in some way to all this stuff. And that has to do with what used to be termed wolf children, but the more accepted, there's a more accepted name nowadays, like feral children, I think it's called, F-E-R-A-L, feral children.
Mm-hmm.
Those are kids which, at an extremely young age, are somehow isolated from the human community and raised by animals. And, of course, there's a lot of debate about this phenomenon, because there have been hoaxes and there have been situations where there was never any clear-cut evidence that, you know, that the thing occurred that way.
Mm-hmm.
But then, on the other hand, there have been so many reports of this type that even statistically speaking, some of them must be true. And the reason why I'm interested in it is because in the two or three incidences that were the best documented, they managed to identify who the child was, and it's a question of the fact that the kid went missing as an infant and then showed up around the age of puberty, and of course he was completely non-human, would be the best way to describe it. Running around on all fours, the spine had a permanent curvature, the look in the eyes was that of an animal. You know, you couldn't domesticate it, couldn't teach it to talk. It would steal food at any, you know, at any possibility. And if you interfered with that process, you'd get bitten or scratched.
Sounds like my neighbor's kid.
Yeah, well, I've known a few kids like that myself. But the reason that this is fascinating is because in keeping with the spirit of what we were discussing previously, it leads us to ask the question, what is the actual essence of being human? In other words, what doesn't happen to a child like that that allows him, that prevents him, I should say, from blossoming into a human being, even after he's rescued? If the process is irreversible, something has already been lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so as much as, you know, there were theories that at one time that were quite prevalent, that the so-called natural native or natural man, if he was raised in a pristine environment, away from the influences of humankind and what have you, he would be the true essence of the primal man. And according to that theory, you know, he would lack all of the prejudices and the avarice and the greed and the hostility that, you know, that we tend to demonstrate as a species. And yet these wolf children or these animal children would seem to throw cold water on that theory, because they're not even human at all, never mind being the ideal primal subject. So it would appear as if the contact with other human beings is essential in some way, regardless of what your body happens to be. And so if you're born a human being and raised by animals, you may look like a human being, but apparently you're some kind of an animal. And so if we look at this line of thinking and we project this towards some of the human anomalies that are so difficult to understand, like some of these absolutely heartless, thoughtless, almost mindless types that we have in government and in other places, it really begs the question of what kind of different rearing do these people have? Now, obviously, they had contact with humans, but is it possible that this concept of the human elite, which is so absurd, is actually inbred simply by association and rearing? And can it be possible that the absolute absence of any normal compassion or concern for your fellow man can literally be taught to not manifest as people develop? You know, these are thoughts which were circulating in my mind as we closed that series on our discussions on the development of consciousness. Because our aim, of course, was the escalation of consciousness. But obviously, it could also go the other way. And these elite, in order to be effective shepherds for the sheep, are obviously groomed in a manner which is not normal in its own right. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, you know, the fact that you're bringing this up tonight, Jim, I'm assuming you didn't get a chance to hear last night's show, but we talked about the aspect of the Illuminati, as they like to call themselves, and what's becoming a seamless picture of how the evil, let's say, of the satanic realm, the evil nature of what's negative, what's dark in the universe, has sort of become part of not just this reptilian aspect that we've touched upon and we dealt with for 2 hours last night in relation to Ken's work, but they brought to mind, you know, this whole concept of what I'm working on, and these pictures that Ken recently has been developing brought to our consciousness the link that I think everyone's been looking for. Everyone's wondering who is controlling, who's pulling the strings, who is it ultimately that makes these decisions? Why are they so driven to destroy mankind? And, you know, why, and it entails what you're talking about and the pedophilia and the missing kids and the sex slave industry and mind control and all of this stuff. How could anyone really think that life on this planet could last forever when it's headed for a path of total destruction? And I picked up Fritz Springmeier's book, Bloodlines of the Illuminati, and opened right up to a page that was to deal with what we talked about last night. And here you mention it again, so it's probably worth mentioning. First of all, there's you and I have discussed how they torture within the bloodlines. They torture their young to basically fracture their personalities so that they can tap into various aspects of the mental capacity. So they disregard the soul in the sense that they're not given love for the first 18 months of their lives. And then the second 18 months of their lives, taking them up to age 3, they are given love. But what is that? What kind of love do you think that can be when it comes from these dark creatures, these evil whatever you want to call them, and so they impose this on their children, on their young, and this is a pattern that's carried through their DNA. So there's definitely a DNA connection on the physical end, and I think You know, it could be that these children are, you know, the discards, the ones that they determine they can't control for whatever reason. In other words, they can be so dysfunctional on a multitude of levels that they don't exhibit any capacity to be trained or to be groomed into their hierarchy. And so maybe it's they're discarded by the Illuminati themselves. I don't know that. I haven't done enough research on it. You know, I've read from time to time, and I think that, you know, that would probably be a likely scenario. And these people seem to be soulless, although they like to think they have soul. Their soul focuses on greed and destruction and murder and mayhem and chaos and it's like a disease, you know, that's there's no cure for, and they're just driven to these ends. And Fritz Springmeier talks about that in terms of who the families are. That's one thing. It really doesn't matter who they are, unless we want to apprise ourselves of who we want to steer clear of and gain an understanding of how things run. But it may not be that these children don't have spirits, but they're totally disconnected from the spiritual realm. I think that can happen to a lot of people. That's what produces a psychosis. Is just a total disconnect. They're not operating out of the heart. They're operating out of the head, and so they're deprived of any of the benefits of being connected with the heart, which is your connection to the center of the universe. They have been disconnected from the life source, so to speak. And they're existing sort of like mindless animals in a way. I don't know how much intelligence they exhibit, but I would presume it's probably not a lot, other than maybe what appears to be a survival instinct. So I don't know.
Well, you know that the Germans during World War II had whole villages where women were impregnated by donors of choice, and then they were essentially cared for until they delivered their child. And then at that point, the idea was to isolate these children and raise them as a herd. And impose, you know, belief systems and values and everything that the Nazi state wanted them to possess.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that turned out, because I think it was interrupted by the end of the war. But I read something about that only recently, that there were people who survived that and grew into maturity, and, you know, they've had no end of problems meshing successfully with the rest of humanity.
Uh-huh.
So it would seem to me that, considering the fact that the Nazi philosophy is alive and well, and you know, and well embedded in some of the family lines that you've investigated, for that matter, that it's not beyond possibility that, you know, these kind of tactics are used to groom these children, so that it's not just a question of bloodline and loyalty, but perhaps they're incapable, once the rearing is finished, of being anything but the little monsters that their parents choose to cherish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I know people. I mean, I could even say there may be some people in my family, as there are in every family. You know, you've got, we use the term, you know, he's the black sheep of the family, or she's the black sheep of the family, meaning that they're the one offspring that seems to be totally different from all the others and does things their own way, and regardless what the rules of the house are, and the rules, if there are any rules of the house, that child does something else. And then I've seen young parents that are totally irresponsible with their kids. They don't teach their kids manners. They don't teach them etiquette, and they might as well be living out in the wild. And yet they act as though everything's normal. You know, the parents, the young parents, and they could be not necessarily teenagers, in their 20s or 30s. I've seen adults act that way. So they've succeeded in creating a couple of generations of dysfunctional kids who really can't be parented, and that's what they prefer. They prefer to have a loose-knit family system that the kids don't obey the parents and they disobey authority, and it gives them this constant means to confront chaos, you see, which is intent on just pulling our rights or taking our rights away from us, whichever ones we may still have. And you know, that's bothered me when parents don't take care of their kids and or discipline them. They just the kids actually just make mileage out of their inadequacies, and others have to suffer the consequences. And I would presume on other planets where the people are more evolved, not, and I don't necessarily mean technologically speaking, usually that comes with the territory, but on other planets, I'm sure that the elders of the society are training those parents, or at least taking care of the kids while someone else is training the parents to be parents, and, you know, to be adults. And we have that here. I mean, we have a completely dysfunctional society from top to bottom as far as the mainstream masses are concerned. Yes, there are exceptions, and we know where those are. But most of us can look at society in general, and people are sleepwalking. How can you expect their kids to demonstrate any semblance of inspiration that they got from their parents when all they learn is how to sleepwalk? You know?
Well, I agree with you, and I have seen some examples of rearing children which are totally off the wall. I don't remember if it was in the 70s or the 80s, but I remember seeing totally unruly children in a restaurant once, and it was really weird because the parents would just talk to them and give them suggestions, but they wouldn't discipline them in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. You know, like the father would say, I really don't think it's a good idea for you to throw that food at the other table. You know, instead of reaching over and belting the kid in the head, which certainly gets the message across, you know.
Evident footprints has become violent tonight. Let's mark this date down. I'm just kidding.
I don't mind telling you, I was raised that way. My old man didn't take any BS from me. I got the belt, and when I got older, I got worse. But I don't think it hurt me any. I'm still reasonably functional, and I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
But to let a kid be completely unruly and just mention suggestions of what you think he should do, you might as well not say anything. Because, well, you know, yeah, if the behavior becomes ingrained, and the more you complain, the more they do what they want to do.
Yeah, there's, you know, that's usually the case when ego is the method through which they run the family, you know. The kids' wants and needs are met through their cries and their displeasure with what they don't have and the way they talk back to adults and their disrespect for authority and their unappreciative nature, you know, that this expectation that they have to have something just because they're there. And that definitely plays into the mind control on this planet. Everything is, you've got to have this. You have to have the best. But if you can't afford the best, you can get this great deal at Walmart. You know, this thinking that, you know, the only way you can eat is if you go to a fast food restaurant, and everything else has to be fun and games. And I'm not saying that life shouldn't be fun or it shouldn't be interesting, but there's no nurturing going on. That's what we're describing, I guess. You know, this sense of worth, self-respect, self-worth, self-esteem, not ego-based, but, knowing who you are. You know, it's consciousness, you know, and there's a heck of a lot of, if people are sleepwalking, they're not conscious, you know. We're describing the same thing, I think, in a myriad of ways. So, now back to those kids. You know, what really ticks me off is when I hear these people, these experts, they're animal experts, and they say animals don't have souls. You know, I have to disagree, because I see animals have more soul than a lot of people.
Oh, and smart.
Oh yes, and unfailing loyalty and love and respect and appreciation. You know, they perform. They decide what they have to do to perform. They're so grateful for, you know, for the training and the attention and the food and the warmth and the shelter. They appreciate those things. You know, and how can you say they don't have a soul? Or how can they, I don't mean you, Jim, you know that. How can anyone say that animals just act on instinct, that they go by the tone of your voice? Because I can whisper everything I say to my animals, and they understand every word I'm saying.
And actually I've heard, never mind the soul issue, I've heard so many of these so-called animal people say, well, animals can't really think. They can only mimic. And actually,
God,
that's been proven to be absolutely false, especially in the last 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
They have quite a mind. Just because they can't get up and give the Gettysburg Address does not mean that they cannot think. And that's one of the problems with human beings. You know, they judge everything only by themselves and assume that, you know, that they are the superior expression of life on this planet. And it may actually not be true.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but how do we know that a porpoise isn't a far more sublime animal, for instance, than a human being? Why? Because they don't have cities, they don't have cars.
Yeah, porpoises.
Or they don't have airplanes. You don't know what they have that we don't have.
Yeah. Porpoises, dolphins, and whales, as far as I know, metaphysically, are retaining certain frequencies on this earth for us. And they're communicating with the higher realms on our behalf, which is the whole purpose of their language. And, you know, we have the Navy training them to fetch objects like dogs. And these very same people are saying animals are stupid. You know, they're training these animals to do things. And it always has to be militarization of whatever seems to have some benefit, you know. Some miracle has to always be turned into a weapon or some means of gaining on someone so you can kill them. It never ceases to amaze me how limited the possibilities seem to be to those that make scientific discoveries of that nature. And then turn around and lie about it, you know. The doublespeak again. But I know you're not that way, Jim. So
No, actually, I'm very, very fond of animals, and most particularly dogs, one of my very favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Horses, whales, and elephants. I think those are, I mean, I absolutely love elephants. I don't know why, I always have. But if you've ever been around any of these animals, now, like, we've had German Shepherds in our family for several generations. As a matter of fact, my son just bought one a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually live with an animal, now, like, I lived with my German Shepherd for, it must have been 18 years before he passed away. And I'm here to tell you that you can actually watch the wheels turn in that head. They figure stuff out. They know what you're saying. They know you better than you do.
Sure.
And the things that they're capable of, if you let them, will astound you. And they know when you're feeling blue, and they know when you're happy, and they know your ways. It's really an amazing thing if you allow it to grow. You can have an amazing relationship.
And it's
amazing
also,
in another respect too, Don, because sometimes, as you hinted at earlier, you can have a much richer and more fulfilling relationship with an animal than you can with a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true. And I was going to add that they're also very sensitive to what might be ailing you. And I don't mean just in a mood sense, but, you know, they have ways of knowing if you have heart problems or problems with your kidneys or your circulation in general. And they will respond accordingly. And they've saved people's lives.
Oh, sure.
By knowing what to do in that case. So, actually, I've experienced that myself. So, you know, I'm a witness to that.
Well, some of the stories you've told me about your favorite pet, I don't know if you want to mention that or not, are pretty astounding in their own right. And, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that you're a friend of mine and you're telling me these things openly, I would almost doubt that they actually occurred because they're so fantastic.
Well, everyone else that's had that experience has said the same thing. And even while they're witnessing it, whether it's in person or with a telephone, they're astounded. So, you know, it can be proven, you know, and it's not really difficult. You know, when you have a performer that likes to perform, you know, he or she is going to perform. There's no stopping them. And you know, my animals are no exception.
Well, getting back to the animal intelligence issue, there were several books that I read in the recent past which just blew my mind. One of them was called The Mind of the Porpoise. And the woman who wrote that was a trainer of porpoises for many years. And she describes certain situations where she thought she was training them, and it turned out they were actually training her. And it's really amazing when you read it in detail and see how clever they were about getting their points across without terrifying the woman, because when she was first starting out, she was actually afraid of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got some very, very amazing teeth. And that was her biggest concern, was the working with the teeth. And the other thing that was even more astounding, in my opinion, was this book. I forget the name of it, but it was written about this chimpanzee that was raised from infancy and taught signing at a very early age. And by the time that she was an adult, she had a vocabulary of several thousand words, and she could express herself in an amazing variety of ways by signing. And the neat thing was how she reacted when they deliberately presented her with something that she had never seen before. And in this one instance, which to me was an extraordinary example of the power of the animal mind, they presented her with a Halloween mask. They didn't tell her anything about it or explain it to her or anything. Just one of them came in wearing a mask.
Yeah,
and when she realized that it was a covering for the face, and saw, you know, recognized the person who was underneath it, and she began talking about it, and in an effort to identify the object, she invented a name for it, and she called it a face hat.
Yeah,
and you know that's absolutely deductive logic. I mean, she didn't know what it was. They never gave her a name for it or anything, but she knew that a hat covered the head and this thing covered the face.
Yeah.
And so she invented that name. Now, you're not going to tell me there's no mind there. That's not mimicking.
Oh, of course, you know. You know, the animal Jim's referring to, for those of you out there in the listening audience, is my bird. And he asks questions and he makes requests. He tells me what he wants to eat. I can ask him what he would like to eat and he tells me. And he speaks in English. Sometimes he speaks in Spanish. It's remarkable, and I may not have something, you know, in the house that he wants, and I have to go get it. And the issue of how I'm going to get it becomes a topic of conversation. Now, you have to experience this, Jim. You've heard that already. I know to some extent you've heard some of it. And there were other.
Well, I've heard you carrying on with him on the phone. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah, that's what you're hearing. And you know, there are times, there are times when someone is concerned that there may be some violence going on. You know, like I'm abusing kids or anything or something. You know, and it's funny because he sounds like a person. He sounds exactly like a kid. And so I guess when you hear that voice over the telephone, it's like, you know, why is the kid screaming like that? You know, he's trying to get attention. And he's calling me by name. I mean, you know, that's, with words, you know, he's calling my name or he gives me a nickname or he invents songs and sings and scats and improvises. You know, he shows the same traits in music that I exhibit when I'm practicing or I'm performing. He does it too. And he sings in tune. He's got perfect pitch. You know? I mean, he has perfect pitch. He can sing a note. I have perfect pitch and I know he's got perfect pitch. It's simple to see. You know? So, They're remarkable. Mind, they have minds. Let me tell you, they're absolutely brilliant. Souls, they're equally capable in that realm as well.
Well, now, I've long since concluded, Don, that anything that possesses life has a soul.
Yes.
And I'm sure that I'm right. I don't need to consult anything. My inner being tells me that that's a truism.
Yes, and I agree with you. You're absolutely correct. However, there may be some exceptions to that, though.
Yes, but you know what's interesting about those exceptions?
Yeah.
They've denied themselves a soul by virtue of what they've chosen to do.
Exactly. See, you read my mind. So, yes. Yes, that's true. And I agree.
And the interesting thing about that is, and I've had this discussion with a number of people over the years, I said, how evil can you actually be in the course of a lifetime and still possess some kind of a remnant of a soul when you're gone, you know, when you die? And a lot of people have said to me, and these are, I'm talking about people who study occult sciences. I'm not just talking about asking Joe Blow off the street. And the answer that I've gotten back is that if you're evil enough and persistent enough, you can lose your soul literally, which means that when you die, you don't. There is no more you. There's nothing that's survives. And then they've gone to the further extent of hypothecating that if you're really wicked enough, you can literally have the equivalent of a negative soul, or in other words, you're owing.
Yeah, I've hypothesized that many times myself, so I would agree with you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, those are astounding thoughts. You certainly don't get them out of your catechism book, but it makes sense.
So if you have two negative souls together, let's say they join in matrimony, do you get one positive soul out of that? Because of adding a negative and a negative, or do you have two negatives? You know, do you have a negative two?
Well, I don't know what you have, but I would venture to say that if two really negative type individuals decided to produce an offspring, I think that the way, knowing a little bit about the nature of God and the way things work, I would really venture to say that the child that would come forth from that union would actually be normal in the beginning. In other words, there's nothing going to be passed on to produce what was the name of that that guy that was supposed to be the devil's son?
Oh, are you talking about Little Nicky?
No.
Adam Sandler movie?
In that movie that Gregory Peck played in, where
Damon?
Damien. I don't believe that, you know, that you would be able to produce a Damon, you know, just by the normal act of.
Or I think it's Damien. Yeah.
I think you would have to destroy the soul of that individual through a process, because God certainly doesn't. The creation, the act of creation, doesn't produce that kind of a being normally.
Yeah, you know,
and
the
I think
very
that's one of the reasons why it's so why it's such an evil act,
mm-hmm,
to perpetuate that type of person in the world is because you have to knowingly interfere with his normal development and produce a monster.
Well, you know, the creed of those people is the end justifies the means. So that's always foremost in their intent. And so there's really no concern, because there are no consequences. At least, you know, in their thinking, there's no consequences. And it, you know, we talked about, last night, we talked about the blood-drinking rituals that they engage in. You know, Ken Adachi has been studying this for a long time and has had the great fortune to be in contact with a lot of people who have been exposed to some of this stuff. And we've all heard about it from time to time, and it's put before us in the movies and in books and stories. we're somehow to accept that this is normal for things to be that way. Well, in their world, the way they've created it, that's what they chose. And how can you understand their purpose if you don't understand your own? You know, that's really the key to us overcoming all this stuff is just coming to the realization of who we are and why we're here. And then it's easier to understand those other aspects of, what exists in this three-dimensional world. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, as we were talking before the show, and I mentioned the article that I read concerning the photographs that were taken of the Obamas getting off that plane, and I don't know who wrote that article, but maybe it was Kanadachi, but there was a paragraph in there that was pretty amazing. And he said, the author said, that probably the reason why they weren't able to uphold their form at that moment was because they had been traveling around the world, they were exhausted. And he said, and besides, he said, being on the military jet and in the company of other people, they hadn't had the opportunity to engage in the blood fest, which is what gives them the energy to maintain their form. Now, that's a pretty incredible statement. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, actually, I said that to Ken some time ago, and when he and I were looking at the pictures, he asked me, and that I just blurted that out. But he's come across that very same statement with some other people, too, who have described the same phenomenon. And it's the, when you are torturing someone or you are about to consume some aspect of their being and you show your true self, it can create a tremendous amount of fear. And in some cases, these victims are conscious, but they're under some control. They're either drugged or they're under hypnosis or some spell or something, okay? And basically, they express fear, but they're paralyzed. They can't do anything about it. So you can imagine the amount of adrenal chrome that they're generating. And that's what these reptilians enjoy is that, they get a high off of it. And so the fear factor is very important to this whole thing. But when Ken asked me, he said, why do you think they're shape-shifting right there? And I said, they need to be fed. And, I didn't hesitate to think about it at all. I've considered that part of their ability to shape-shift into our DNA pattern is to consume some of our DNA. And their big hang-up is on the bloodlines. So obviously, they enjoy drinking the blood. And he actually shared a story with our listening audience and me about someone who had witnessed Al Gore with jars, large jars of human blood on an airplane, and he was drinking it. And I guess if you're in tune to global warming, that's a it's probably a nice cooler. that's a sick joke, but I mean, how do you cope with such a topic? That's the depravity of the people that are running this planet. And now one reason why I mentioned this and Fritz Springmeier too is because he made a correlation between the spiritual and the mental physical aspect of this whole thing, and he referenced the secret Illuminati groups that go to a particular castle in Strasbourg, and he was, from war to war and throughout history, Strasbourg has shifted from France to Germany and back innumerable times. But they go there. This is a very secret castle that they use for a lot of their major rituals. And Fritz Springmeier describes one of these rituals where they summoned Satan himself, and he appeared as a winged draconian reptilian, or for short, they call them Dracos. Now, Fritz Springmeier claims that he saw the pictures that were taken, too. He saw the photographs. So, there's your correlation.
We actually covered that in one of our shows last year.
Yeah, we've covered it many times. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we talked about is it just a coincidence that people who have supposedly seen the devil or sketched what they believe to be the devil after having had some sort of a psychic or occult experience. Why is it always reptilian looking? Why does it have horns and scales and lizard features and claws and a pointed tail and all this kind of stuff? You know, it could be anything, but why is it always that? And it's just an amazing coincidence, if it is a coincidence, that they would choose that shape, and yet, and now with all this business emerging about these reptilian extraterrestrials that are truly running the planet, it seems like it's more than a coincidence somehow, you know?
Well, and you know, this is a difficult topic for a lot of people, and yet I've heard people say, well, these aren't really aliens, these are demons. Well, there's a demonic aspect to it, but they fly in ships, too. You know, and they are into many things that that the elite are into. In fact, they're working for these people or these beings. I don't know. You can call them people. We use these words so loosely, you know. But they participate. The elite participate in the same things the reptilians do. In fact, it's come to many people. David Icke talks about this a lot. Fritz Springmeier is another one that talks about it quite a bit. Ken Adachi, Jeff Rentz, I talk about it. You talk about it. Randy, our friend Randy's talked about it. Native Americans talk about it, that there are other races of people that come and go to this planet. Why is that a taboo subject? Well, people are going to think you're nuts. Why are you worried about what people think of me? Is it because if you admit that you give it some consideration, that then they'll say something about you? See, they're not really concerned about me. Isn't it ironic that you could be going through all kinds of problems in your life and really need help from someone else, and there's nobody there to help you? But when it comes to you revealing the truth, boy, don't do that. You better watch out. All of a sudden, everybody becomes concerned. You see, because they really don't want to face what their fears are. You know?
Well, I could never understand that myself. Because whether you want to face it or not, it's there.
It's
there. So you
might
as well just get it over with.
Yeah, pretending like it's not doesn't make it go away.
No, that's the old ostrich in the sand routine. You know, it's like I always say, if you got your head in the sand, you got your behind in the air. You're still quite vulnerable.
Yes. Well, you know, the topic that you brought up at the top of the show, we've touched upon, but don't you see those same characteristics in many other people walking around the planet?
Yeah, to different degrees. I mean, that's what I was trying to point out when I said, you know, these animal children are the nth degree, an example of the nth degree of this process. But what if you're not quite that bad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people roaming around that really make you wonder when you encounter them. I think everybody that you talk to has at least one or two tales of that sort. So, I mean, this planet has got a really diverse expression of life on it, even if you just want to talk about the indigenous life.
Yeah. You know, you bring to mind, and I'm in no way comparing these people to the ones you were referring to before, because there's not enough information to make that kind of comparison. But I've had the opportunity to work with people who are disabled for one reason or another, and I've been able to, and using music as a modality to get them to open up and to heal or to expand their awareness. And I would be told things that such and such a person has this disability and they have a mind of a 6-month-old child. And the thought that went through my head was, what doctor, what genius came up with that conclusion?
Yeah, how was the measurement made?
Yes, exactly. Because generally speaking, it varies from person to person at 6 months as to how that child develops. Some, I know, some that can swim when they're a couple of months old and they can talk and they can read. And I have a nephew that was reading long before he was a year old and reading more than one book in a day. And a voracious reader and exhibiting other talents too. So when you see that and then someone tells you something like that, that just drives you all the more to succeed, to reach that person. And it took a couple of weeks to develop relationships with these people because they were all different. They all had different problems. And I started, we started experiencing miracles. Those that were paralyzed all of a sudden were able to move and play musical instruments and sing. And we put together a holiday musical event, a concert that just blew everybody's mind. They didn't think that this could be done. And I was approached afterwards and congratulated for having done such a great job with these people. And yet I said, they get the credit. They get the credit. I just delivered the message. They're the ones that developed this. They brought it out from within them. I just aided them or I assisted them in bringing what's inside them out for you to see. And then I was told, they didn't want to see any more miracles. I was specifically told that they didn't want to see miracles because when these people get healed and they leave, the company loses money. And I said,
isn't
well,
that the truth?
Oh yeah. I said, well, I'm out of here. and that was something that really, I had to make that decision just because I couldn't stand being around those kind of people. And, to the detriment of everyone else, you see. Well, what am I to do? What else, alternative?
Well, I think you did the right thing because you can't compromise your own integrity. That's rule number one.
Yeah.
And so you have to walk away from garbage like that.
Yeah, but you know what? The potential to perform miracles was there. And really, they're not even miracles, Jim. It's just doing what's right to get the right results. That's all that is. It's not even a miracle. I think what's miraculous about it is that somebody actually does it. It's always there for us. It's available to everyone.
Every culture on the planet has stories about miracles. And some of them are exceedingly old. It's been going on for as long as there has been humanity. So I tend to agree with you. It's a condition. It's almost like a resonance or an alignment of some sort. And when it's properly done, it has miraculous results.
Yeah.
The only reason it looks miraculous is because it's not done very often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this strange tendency as human beings that if you only see something once in a blue moon, then it's got to be really special or supernatural. But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen every day if the conditions were right.
Yes, of course.
Yes, of course.
And when's the last time you saw a blue moon?
What's that?
When is the last time you saw a blue moon?
A blue moon?
Well, yeah, you said once in a blue moon.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that because I have used that expression simply because my dad used to use it, but I read somewhere one time that there actually is a blue moon, and I forget what causes it. But it is a rare phenomenon, and apparently it's real, but doesn't happen very frequently. So if anybody knows what a blue moon is, you ought to call in. They'll give us something else to discuss.
Yeah, a couple of years ago I read about that. I came across it accidentally, and it left my consciousness as fast as it went in. You know? So... I knew the song Blue Moon, but that's about the extent of it. But I guess
I don't mean to say anything negative, but you are breaking up something terrible as far as what I can hear is concerned, and I'm having trouble discerning what you're saying at this point.
Okay, what I just heard from our engineer, Jim, if you can understand what I'm saying, is that you're coming through fine. You sound fine to me, and I guess I sound okay. So we're reestablishing our connection with Jim Murray, folks, so that we can continue on with this show before we sign off. I'll take a moment here while we're waiting for Jim to come back, and I've got Don talking in my other ear, so I had to pause for a second. Next week I have Michael Anthony on Monday evening, and Rick Adams will be on the 28th. That's Tuesday. I'm looking forward to that very much. I was on Rick's show last week, and Ken Adachi will be with us on Thursday. Joe Church, who we couldn't get on Wednesday night, will be with us, and also on the 1st of May, Mr. Jim Murray, and Jim is back with us now. What a segue. Jim, can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay. Can you hear me okay now?
Perfectly.
Okay. Very good. I guarantee I'm not doing anything different from what I was doing before. So it might have been Ma Bell.
Is that woman still around?
Well, she must be, you know. She must be. Let's see. Basically what I actually lost my train of thought now. what we were talking about. But it was another one of my kernels of wisdom, let's put it that way. You know, it'll come back to me.
The last thing we were talking about was a blue moon, and you said you had
I know
about
the song.
It also, but it just went right out of your head.
Yeah, I know the song, but there's some aspect about the moon, I think, that makes people, it can make them sad. And from metaphysics, I know that if you're exposed to energies at certain times, when there is a full moon, or the moon could be in various stages, either in waxing or waning, that affect people's moods. It's sort of a reflector of the subconscious. The subconscious memories in the astral plane seem to resonate with the moon, and there's this mystery with that. That's why certain occult groups worship the moon. And then when, you know, all these phenomenon like vampires and wolf men and that, you know, when the moon is full, that's what gets them going. Well, the moon is very significant for a lot of their magic and their alchemy. So there may be a correlation there, but, that's by no means the full meaning of blue moon, but I know that it has a little bit to do with, because when you say, you know, you're feeling blue, you're a bit sad, and if you have too much blue light in your aura, it can bring you down, at least in your mood.
Yeah, definitely. As a matter of fact, it's interesting you bring that up, because I have a couple of friends who can see auras, and they have told me unequivocally that some of the expressions that we have in our language are actually subconscious reporting, if you want to use that term, as to the condition of the aura under various conditions.
Like
and,
green,
there's
green
a whole
with
bunch
envy.
Of them that have invaded our language, like green with envy, for instance.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I just said, yeah.
Oh, you did? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
we got a little bit of a delay, so yeah.
But, I mean, those things are apparently, aspects of reality which get injected into language, even though not everybody can directly perceive them. And that in itself is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we say things like red with anger, but then people get red-faced when they're angry, but they exhibit more red in their aura, too. And it's usually in the wrong place. That's the whole thing, you see, because when you become green with envy, envy is a thought process. It's not a heart process. You know, it's ego-based. The ego loves to attach itself to the mind because the mind can be very fleeting and very unpredictable and influenced by a lot of things, whether it wants to be or not, or whether you want it to be or not. You know, it takes quite a bit of discipline to train your mind to not pay attention to certain things. And so, yeah, those colors are applicable to our natural energies, and having them be out of balance or having them be shifted to the wrong part of our anatomy, so to speak. You know, our metaphysical anatomy.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. By the way, do you know anyone who can see auras?
Well, I do. My pets do.
Oh, I know animals do.
Yeah.
I'm sure of that.
You know, birds are great at seeing auras. Yes, I know some other people, too. I actually, you know, well, I know quite a few people who can.
The interesting thing that I found out is most of the people that I've met who can see auras have been in the martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that they didn't always have that ability, but that it developed as a consequence of what they were learning, which is kind of interesting.
Yes, when you get to a certain stage in any of the martial arts, you become an empath of sorts because there's a lot of anticipation of what the other person is doing, and you're not just perceiving movement per se. You know, when someone's learning martial arts, they're focusing on hands and feet, you know, fists and watching motions, and they're not really focusing on the whole thing, the whole experience. And so as you get into perceiving and anticipating what the experience is, you actually tune into it as if you're seeing it before it happens. And
know that for a fact. Definitely true.
Yeah, that seeing also expands into that phenomenon that you just described. When you become good at one, the other one comes along for the ride.
Yeah, and there are certain exercises and I don't know what you would call them, rituals perhaps, associated with various types of martial arts that are actually designed to enhance your psychic and spiritual abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty amazing when you start to think of it that even though martial arts for the most part have been used, you know, for self-defense and for fighting, that's a path that can actually lead you to a higher consciousness in its own right.
Mm-hmm. And yoga does the same thing, too.
Sure.
Because of its specificity. Now, I've not had that experience with jumping jacks. But...
jumping jacks.
You know, I mean, the exercise is good.
You'd have to do an awful lot of jumping jacks before you would experience anything really occult in nature.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, Jim, I hate to say it, but we're about out of time here. It's been interesting and it's been fun. So you know, because you had asked me earlier, you know, where I was with this massive article. This is really a lot of stuff, but I think it's going to be very interesting for people to really study this and get into it. They'll develop their higher senses when they gain the ability to see the images within the images within the images. And Ken's work is not singular in these phenomena that we were talking about. We didn't really go into the details other than to reference the source of the photos and some of the phenomena that are there. But there's definitely shape-shifting going on there, and there's shape-shifting going on in some of the photos that I'm dealing with. In fact, it was in the beginning of my research that I came upon a particular photo that demonstrated that there's a lot more to some of these politicians than we could ever imagine.
So, I can believe that without any deep consideration. I can believe that.
And in reference to everything we talked about tonight, these are realities that are there, and we needn't fear them. Fear is not serving any purpose for us whatsoever. It's the tool that they use. Fear is not, it's not natural. It's not of our nature. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do, because I know that when I was younger, especially, I was almost completely fearless. And later on, you accept certain things as the world presents them to you, and once you do that, it becomes a nucleus for the development or the generation of fears. You know, so I think it's part of the conditioning.
Yes. Yes, you know, those are learned experiences, and they're encouraged through the language that we're taught and the ideals that we are taught to accept without questioning, and this peer pressure of being a good citizen or being a good this or that, being a good little gold miner. We become overly attentive to the physical realm, and we sacrifice the spiritual. And really, we should never be doing that. We should never disregard who we really are. That comes up in every conversation that we've had on this show for months. Is knowing our purpose, knowing why we're here, and making some choices, making some decisions about that, rather than waiting for someone else to make the decision for us. And I suppose where we do know these things, rather than waiting for the government to take care of people or to come up with some solutions to these problems, we should be doing it ourselves, shouldn't we, Jim?
I think that would be a superb undertaking if all the folks in our country decided to do that. I mean, there isn't really anybody out there who is at least not mildly acquainted with what needs to be done. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like legal jargon. You know, if you could take a 7-page contract that's filled with, you know, highfalutin legal terms, and when you boil it all down, you probably wind up with 2 or 3 sentences that would make sense to everybody. And the same disproportional degree of complexity is associated with all of the problems in our nation, from banking, you know, down to military and down to, you know, international trade. But in reality, if you take 2 ordinary people off the street and confronted them with these issues, they could knock it out an explanation of what's really going on in very few words, because their intentions are pure. They're not trying to bamboozle anybody with a lot of complexity. And that's part of the art of politics, for some stupid reason, which I'll never understand. It's like they weave a mystery about everything so that the uninformed can't participate. But they never really address the real issue. And so it's down to the common man to be able to do that. You know, after all, there were common men interacting all over the world before there were elite politicians spouting endless amounts of steam.
Yeah, that's true. I'm laughing because it's very visual what you said, but it's very true. More than steam, actually, but I won't go there.
Well, I didn't want to get too, you know, verbose.
Yeah.
Or too vulgar in my descriptions.
Yeah. Exactly. But you came up with steam. That was an interesting replacement. I probably would have said fertilizer. Oh, man. Well, Jim, it's been interesting. I'm hoping to have this article posted very soon. I may even get it up tonight. But for the listening audience's edification, it's my intention to get this done. And then we're going to have some magnified crops that we're going to add to this. It's not going to have any negative impact to the article, but it's actually going to enhance it a bit more, make some things more visible, because you can only magnify these things so much within the context of the computer screen and as a whole picture, because this article is about the photos that were released prior to the campaign, and they're documenting a family history. There's some really interesting phenomenon. I've never seen things like this happen. For instance, I can give the example without giving the whole thing away. There's a certain character in a picture, and when you try to see where a layer may have been created in the photo. You can alter light a little bit, and certain things jump out, and you can see, oh, that doesn't belong there because it really looks out of place now. And so when you return it back to normal sample that we saw, you can see how that has been hidden, and you still see that the image doesn't belong there. It's just masked a little better. Now, I came up with a technique where even though I may be using a black and white photo, I treated it as if it were a color photo, and I brought down the white point aspect ratios and the black point aspect ratios to zero, and one individual in the picture changed completely in appearance. And it's the subject of this whole study. So it's pretty interesting. And as I had these photos analyzed by a photographic expert, he was really impressed with this image, how it jumps out, and it looks different from every other image. So you can understand a bit what the process was. Imagine a group of people and everyone's wearing dark trousers, and you want to see if there's anything strange in the vicinity of the figure that looks like they don't belong in the picture. And so you do these manipulations with the light, and everyone's trousers stayed dark except this one person's. They turned silver. Everyone else's pants were coal black. It's a very interesting phenomenon. So I discovered a layer, and I discovered that manipulating the light would expose that layer. Even though there are, I'm told by this expert, that there are very expensive programs that will actually ascertain how those pictures are constructed. Whew. I'd love to have that, because I spent hours doing this manually. But he feels I'll get the same results anyway. So there may come a time when I can do it and allow the computer to do the whole thing. But I learned quite a bit about how these pictures are altered in the process. And it's like martial arts. You're discerning what's happening, and you feel and see things are way out of place. And so you get to the bottom of it, and then there's more things that seem way out of place. So it's complicated, but I'm hoping that everybody gets to take a look at this in the very near future.
Well, I'm waiting on it, and I'll be more than happy to read the article and give you my impressions.
Okay. Yes. Okay, Jim. Well, I'm going to wish you a wonderful weekend, and I look forward to your show next week. I look forward to your response after you have a chance to read this piece of work. It's been a labor. I don't know, it's a labor of love, but it's a labor. You know, the idea is to bring this information out. So I look forward to our next show, and on our behalf, I'm going to say goodnight to our listening audience. You have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, and our special guest, Jim Murray, who will be back with us next Friday. In the meantime, special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Seth Hendrick, we are praying for you and your family in this time of sorrow, and look forward to your return. And you, the listening audience, thank you for tuning in. Join us again next week when we run another series of shows, Monday through Friday, right here on BBS Radio. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.